Hi, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace. Sabine M. And in today's episode, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Nelson. Elizabeth is an author, co-founder, and head of innovation at Smart Building Certification. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm with Elizabeth Nelson. I met her recently at an event where she had a presentation around healthy office buildings. That was really, really fun because she was talking about, well, sex and drugs and then healthy office aspects as well. And actually how sex and drugs are kind of contributing to the healthy office environment. So very, very interesting. And since then, I also got her book, The Healthy Office Revolution, which was a really great read. So we're going to tap a bit into her findings there as well. So hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. Let's start what I usually start asking people what they do today and how they came there, what their professional background is.
Yeah, I guess the fun answer is, and what I hope to be, I consider myself a disruptor. I really think that there's some exciting opportunities to shake up the way that we work, to do things better, to be more informed. But the maybe more informative answer to that is I'm a writer, a researcher, and entrepreneur. So I have two companies that I run. I very much look into the research. I work with a lot of universities. I study the way that we work. And then I also am a co-founder of the Smart Building Certification. We started early in 2020 and have really had an amazing ride with that and what we can do with technology in the building and how we as an ecosystem and a group of widely diverse industries can work together to make buildings better and to change business models and be more competitive in the war for talent and all of those wonderful things.
Now, I didn't mention the subtitle of your book before, which is A True Story of Burnout, A Wake-Up Call, and Better Working Through Science. And you do share your very personal story, which made the book quite catching. So I read it quite quickly. What inspired you to share that very personal story? Because I do feel like I know a lot about your young life, at least.
Yeah, my 20s are really out there now. I meet a lot of people. Know about my 20s. I think after I burned out and when I started going kind of on this mission to study burnout, to study the way that we work and see if we can do better, I just was so motivated that I thought we could do so much better, that we could change the way that we work, know ourselves better, work in better environments, work in teams that work for everyone, that sort of thing. But I didn't want to write the book at all. I told the story. And someone said, that's a book. And I said, yeah, okay, I guess I would read that book. I said, yeah. And we kind of started talking about it and we wrote the book, but not from my perspective. So the first part, I think her name was May or April or something. And it was my story, but it wasn't me. And then the second part was the sort of Freakonomics science and the research that I did and what's going on in the world right now. And started talking to people about it, talked to some publishers, and they said, what are you doing? Like, you have this amazing story, and you're hiding behind this character, and everybody's going to ask. You have to just, I just got a little bit brave for quite a while and wrote it completely from my perspective. And I'm really glad I did. It's been an amazing way to connect with people, and putting yourself out there often results in other people putting themselves out there or that kind of thing. So I'm glad I was brave in that moment and did what I initially didn't want to do at all.
Yeah, I'm glad you were too, because it is quite a powerful thing to share. And one thing that stuck with me, and that since I've read it, I've discussed it with a couple of colleagues here, that during your time at the agency, so your first job, people were a lot of the times telling you, you're too nice for this. It's such a shame that you're not allowed to be nice in the business world to be taken seriously. Why is that? I mean, that's not normal.
Yeah, I had a couple of people call me Betsy for a while because they thought it was a better indicator of my personality that I was too nice for advertising. So they changed my name. And the truth is people that work in advertising are wonderful, lovely people. That's not, I think, what they were getting at. Their personalities are the reason that they can do such amazing things and convince athletes to do these cool commercials and very creative things and that be so accomplished in that. But I think there is something about setting some boundaries for yourself and actually saying, I'm not going to do that, or I need to rest, or, you know, that rock and roll lifestyle a little bit. Some of the most successful people at the agency were diva-ish at times. And I was probably too young to be diva-ish and get away with it. But saying, I worked like crazy all week and I'm not coming into the office today. I'm staying in my pajamas. I'm sleeping till 12 and I'm not available, you know? And that became less and less as I kept working with the agency. And I think it showed, because I think that moment of saying I've given so much more than expected, and then now I'm going to rest a little bit, is important. I think there is sort of this silliness about the 40-hour work week that we can, like machines, just work 40 hours and projects never are more tasking or more involved. And there are dips and flows, and that's how people work anyway. So I think that was the nice thing about me. I think they were worried that what happened was going to happen. So, yeah.
True. Now, you mentioned before that you're doing a lot of research on how we can change the way we work, actually, and that, 2020 has been kind of a wake-up for everybody to that. Now, looking forward, what do you think are the things that we do need to change? I mean, you just said the 40-hour working week, probably. And I know a couple of countries are actually experimenting with the 4-day working week now and having good results around that. So what are the things that we should reconsider?
Oh, I mean, I think we should reconsider most of it, to be honest. But whenever I'm talking to someone, I usually say there's so much that we're doing wrong with the way that we're working now. Anything that we want to play around with that we put some due diligence towards will probably be an improvement. But I think we need to, as individuals, learn how we work best, you know, and push for that. And I think organizations need to value the way that we work best and do that. So if it makes sense, one of the things that they say is very challenging for later chronotypes to get to the office on time. And they're actually just living in a time zone that they're uncomfortable in, sort of, where they're forcing themselves to wake up. We shouldn't have to set an alarm in the morning. If you do, that means you're either waking up earlier than you should and you're a later chronotype, or you're not getting enough sleep and you need to rest more. So this idea that we're forcing those kind of individuals into just constant jet lag kind of for the work week and then having them recover on the weekend, which isn't possible. Sleep is compounded. We need to just sleep well consistently. So I think learning who we are and fighting for that, I think built environments need to support all of the different types of people as well. Introverts are very underrepresented in the way that the workplace is designed. We did that amazing exercise at the conference that we met, and it just shows that these introverts are actually often later chronotypes as well. So you get this sort of pool of people who just are really under much more stress at the office to fit into something that they don't fit into. So I think we need to find out how we work best, and we need structures, organizations, and workplaces that support these diverse individuals.
I agree very much. And what I think, so I'm an introvert as well. And for a long time, when I was also in my 20s, I thought that was wrong. I thought I needed to be different, that I should enjoy social interactions more and being at office parties and that kind of things, and why I didn't want to spend more time with my colleagues. It took me a while to acknowledge that it's perfectly fine, and that although I'm not the one who thrives at every office party, I still enjoy the connection and the conversations I have. And then I go home at, I don't know, 10 p.m. and it's okay, kind of. But that took a while to get to there and to see that's how I am and that's how I work best. And that leads me to the question, is how do we need to shift our mindsets now to make hybrid work work?
Yeah, I think we should get away from the idea of expecting people to come to the office and start, at least in our mindset, saying, okay, if we couldn't force anyone, how would we want to get people to the office? All the people, So what would extroverts want? What would this team profile want? What would introverts want? What is this kind of thing where we want to pull people to the office? And I think that's the simplest way to say how we should change hybrid work is saying, if we couldn't make anyone come, what would we want to change about the office space? And then working towards giving a more flexible model to people. If there is a day where you want more people in the office for collaboration or this kind of thing. But the truth is, that, like you said, there's a lot of success behind this idea of the four-day week, working from home part-time, having people have more time for their life and other things. We know that people are working on the weekends. We also need to, you know, do things for our lives and our families and our homes and get that done. So if we want to think about this idea of a successful business and having then also successful people in there. And by successful, I mean people who are not frantically trying to get something done so that they can be at the office for 9 hours a day, but actually have be in a place where they're in control of their schedule and their home and their work, their well-balanced life. And those are the people that we really are more likely to stay. Those are people who have a stress level that's probably more likely to have them more involved and coming up with those great ideas. We're not doing tasks anymore. So many of our work jobs have to do with creativity and innovation and coming up with new ideas and new ways to do things. That's in every job now. So we really need to think about how do we nurture people not to do 9 hours of a task, but how do we nurture them to actually come up with the business idea that's going to innovate us in the future?
It's more about sustainability here as well, like having people go be successful, but in the long term and not like for these peaks. Now, you tapped into the office should be very different than it is now, catering to introverts, extroverts, chronotypes, all these, and like the healthy aspects that you mentioned, a lot of ideas around how to make office environments more healthy in your book, which I'm going to share with our office manager as well, for sure. Just yesterday, we discussed lighting as well and what can be done there. How do you see the purpose of the office comparing past to going forward?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think we don't have as much pressure on the office for client meetings. And not saying that that isn't there, but I think there was a huge pressure on the office to be these impressive buildings that clients would come to. They would have a coffee and a lunch and would get so impressed by the strength of the business that they would want to do business with this great company. Now I think we have a lot less pressure, and that especially with Corona, we're so much more comfortable doing meetings online, podcasts online, video recordings online. That's something that would have been a much bigger production. So having this sort of digital sphere changed a lot. We also are seeing a huge trend with different generations wanting different things from the office. So the millennials, for example, and Gen Z both really look at flexibility within the workplace, and they will take less pay, it's shown, for a flexible work situation. And we're also seeing the older generation still in that model of, I want a company car and I want the higher pay. And, you know, that's sort of more historical model of this. But the thing is, you know, when we're looking at, for example, Europe, we're expecting in 8 years, 75% of the workforce will be millennials. 75%. This is a generation that is very focused on sustainability. This is a generation that is looking for community and mentorship. This is a generation that is very much in the idea that I want to love my work and I want to love the community of my work. So more of this modern idea where we think of, you know, the kind of cool campuses that we're seeing where you can be there all the time if you want to, but then not have to be there all the time. So we'll see how that goes, but I think we're looking at who's the decision maker right now and then the war for talent. Because, I mean, things like if we're talking about a 4-day week and you're deciding between two companies and one has a 5-day week and one has a 4, that's a huge advantage for that company. So giving some flexibility and this whole idea of results-based work, I think, should also be a part of this. But yeah, so we're seeing a push on there. My opinion is if we have a workplace that really represents all of the type of people and has workplaces that are appropriate for their type of work and their persona, so to speak, how they work best, then you can have a lot of people at the office. I don't think most offices have that right now. I think most offices are more catered towards people who are not sensitive to sound, who are more collaborative in their job role and more comfortable with that. And the fact is, we have these people who need to do coding, for example. We did a huge research study at booking.com, and the coders just said, there's too much noise, there's too much everything around me, I have to focus, and I don't know what to do with that. So we did a huge research study and found out amazing things, but just giving that sound level the appropriate attention that it needs, because some people can't drown it out. And we ended up designing the booking.com headquarters based on sound, actually. So different rooms have different decibel levels, and they also indicate, they kind of nudge that person to have the appropriate sound level then for that. So a coffee corner, you don't have to be quiet because it's next to the desks. You can be social in that area. You can be social in the atrium, but the workplace is very much away and meant to be a very low decibel. So that's kind of the situation where I think we need to just design for our people in mind and design in a way that's flexible. It's going to change. Your workforce is constantly changing. Your clients are constantly changing. So I'm not talking about huge retrofits, but having a space that we're seeing flex workspaces forecasting for what they need, right? And constantly changing. You know, are we doing more conference rooms and meeting rooms, or are we expanding the atrium? What are we doing with the setup of the desks and this sort of thing? So I think we can look to the flex workspace for what to expect in the future. I think they're taking some risks now and experimenting. So it's a really nice time to see what's working for them, what's not. Yeah.
I mean, it's their business model. They need to be, right? If they're not on the forefront, they're not going to get the people in they need to make it work. I think we were briefly discussing when we had our first phone call was as well that many companies do have an employee well-being program, but it oftentimes kind of falls short. So my question is actually, what are some of the things that companies can do wrong around healthy office design and employee well-being programs?
I think first off, I really champion the companies that are doing well-being programs because I think it's a wonderful initiative and it's something that I have pushed for. And I think one challenge that they often run into is this concept of the people who go to the yoga classes or the meditation classes or go for the healthy snacks and this sort of thing or the events are the ones who are healthy, already healthy. I think one of the things is just going after how do we lower the stress of someone who's on the verge of burnout? How do we help people who are frantically working to try to get things done and don't feel like they have the time to take care of themselves, but actually it's probably really needed. So I think there are some amazing things that you can do with the space to lower stress. For instance, there's a great example here. I love digital green areas, so digital nature, so to speak, where you can put it in any space and you can put it in spaces that people have to be. So it's not stuck in the wellness center that you have to choose to go to, but it's in the elevator or it's in the hallway. And there's a great example here in Amsterdam where the elevator is an underwater scene and it's the whole back panel. And as you go up, you go through the, you know, the sunken ship and the octopus and the fish. And it's just it's a very fun experience. But science has shown that those kind of elements of nature, even if they're digital, even if they're not very convincing, they can lower our stress level. They can lower our heart rate. I've spoken with anesthesiologists who have worked in places that have that nature around or big natural scenes in the office. And they can actually give less medicine to the people that are about to go into surgery, which is safer, of course, because their blood pressure is lower. They're not as nervous. They're calmed down. It's amazing. So can we do that for people? Kind of, can we de-stress people passively where we're not asking anything of them? I think that's a really powerful concept to think of. And it's one I did a pitch to the airport here in Amsterdam, and I wanted to take over a hallway and just de-stress people for 15 seconds, 20 seconds, where they're walking through. And it was going really well, but it, it was right before the pandemic, so it didn't happen. The pandemic hit, the project kind of died. But I think there's just this really creative element of how do you take over a public space that people have to go to, where our most stressed people, how can we make the biggest impact? You know, that's where we can make the biggest difference. So I love wellness programs. And then I also love kind of our forced passive wellness for those who are really feeling like they don't have the time to take care of themselves.
I want to dive deeper into the how do you do it right in the office topic, because in your book, you call it your offitopia, which I found really nice to call it like that. From your point of view and from your research, obviously, what does a well-designed and balanced workplace or building look like? So which features, technologies and equipment are in it?
Well, and I think your question kind of hit on one of the biggest things for me. I think technology is one of the best tools that we can use to study what's going on in the office. How are people using the office? How are we working in a sustainable way? Is our business model actually utilizing all of the space and time that we have possible? And how can we improve? Because anything you measure will invariably improve because you know what's going on and you have that information. I think that's one of the biggest things that we've seen with smart building certification. Once people start knowing and looking into this and seeing the data, seeing long-term trends, it's incredible what some of these buildings are coming up with now. The business models that are changing, the way that they're utilizing space or changing space, the way that they're having serious conversations about what's working and what isn't, and then also doing it in a more sustainable way. So getting rid of the waste and putting that into something else. I think what the workplace, there's no cookie cutter for it, right? There's no perfect workspace that can be designed. It should be specific to the building for those people at that time. And I think I am just really inspired by what we're seeing with smart building certification and the case studies of making this just this incredibly wise space that's working for everyone. And I even just down to the simplest things of nobody goes over into this corner. Why don't they go over there? Why isn't this space being used? And looking into that and changing it and making your office something that's constantly evolving and working for you and not in big ways, but just being aware of what's going on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not really a high level approach. It's someone who's on the ground who can understand who's there actually and who sees it for him or herself and can talk to people and ask them about it. So we're here, we now have everywhere QR codes to leave feedback as well. I have a follow-on question actually, because you mentioned now the smart building certification and what you do now with your business. And I'd actually like to understand, how does it work? How do you support these initiatives with the certificate?
So smart building certification, it is what it sounds like. It's a certification of smart buildings. We look at the building from all the technological infrastructure in there, and then we certify it on our five pillars. So the nice thing about our certification is we give you an overall score for your building, but you also get a score for all of your five pillars. So for instance, if you have really responded to and taken steps during the pandemic to have a healthy environment so that people can work safely without the risk of getting sick, then maybe your score within healthy environment and safety and security are very high, right? And then maybe building use and building performance, for example, are not as high, and there's something that you need to work on and look at. And the integrative design is also getting in there. But so you get a score on all of those five. The other thing is, it's not a checklist. So instead of having this ideal smart building that we can make up today, which will probably be outdated by next week, next month, next couple of months, we benchmark you against the smartest building in the world. So last year we named the smartest building the YIT Workery Plus in YAEA in Helsinki, Finland. And you benchmark yourself against this building, but you don't need to have the same setup. So every building is different. You go through our dynamic tool where, depending on what you say you have, the questions show up or they minimize and don't appear. And you can go through this process where you can have a similar score, but have a completely different building. So we believe that there's a lot of flexibility in what a smart building can be. And we also just really believe that this is a moving target. This is something that hopefully is getting smarter and smarter, and it should be something that changes constantly. The other part of this is we are a certification with a network. So we have just about every industry, which is pretty much every industry that is connected with smart buildings. We have architects, we have builders, we have, of course, prop tech companies and technology companies. We have researchers, we have, you know, everyone that you can kind of think of within this area that's part of our network. And we work together a lot, and we have a rule that you have to share your secret sauce to a certain extent, of course, but you have to share your story. And we really work with you to write white papers and press releases so that other people get ideas about how they can make their building smart as well. And people are really eager to share what they're doing, the prop tech companies that we're working with. We have also a certification for prop tech companies where their solution can be certified against our certification. And they say, we are certified within the system and we contribute to these parts of the certification. So really saying, you know, they're ready for the challenge and it's something that they can show to put forward for jobs or other things like that. So we believe in, we're more on a mission than we are a standard certification company. We're trying to make buildings better, faster.
Yeah, I remember in one of my past engagements, still working in corporate real estate on the occupier side, we also had the policy that we don't care about BREEAM or LEED certification because that's in the end a process kind of where you need to tick certain boxes. We care about that the things really work and the builders don't have to, because the certificate's an expense again, they don't have to get the certificate as long as reasonable measures are in place to actually make it sustainable. So I do think that's probably the better approach than greenwashing something in the end.
Thank goodness sustainability is such a big topic right now. You know, we're really excited about some of the progress that is being made. We're very excited about the technologies that are around to eliminate waste and then also pushing for energy neutrality, energy positive buildings. So I hope that that's moving forward. And I think the certification process, hopefully overall, it helps normalize better buildings. And I think all of them are playing a part in that. And I hope that we can do it together.
Another topic that I want to tap into, which is pretty much top of mind everywhere, is diversity. And I do remember that you mentioned that in your presentation as well, how important it is and how you personally benefited from it in your time at the agency as well. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Absolutely. It was such a fun thing to see when I worked at the agency. They had this kind of rule. So within agencies, often you have a copywriter and an art director who work together closely as a team. And what they liked to do is put opposites together. So for instance, you know, the easy one is the super slovenly, like, you know, kind of messy creative genius with the OCD, very, you know, organized on top of it. Kind of a strategic thinker, but also brilliant and creative. And they would put them together. And the first week, they hated it. The other person drove them crazy. You know, it's easy to work with people that we're like, you know, where we go, oh, that's exactly what I was thinking. But when you think about it, when you make teams of people who say, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, you're just paying for an idea two or three times instead of just once, right? So after that first week, these people started making some of the best work of their lives. And really that friction and that opposite and that those different ideas started really working for them. And then you couldn't pull them apart. They were inseparable. And I think when we look at some of the research that's coming out right now, when I talk to some of the research who are looking at how do we create innovation in businesses? How do we get people to meet the people in their building they didn't know they need to meet? Or this idea of serendipity, which is this fantastic strategy they're putting into some companies. Some brilliant people are behind that right now. How do we stop having, for instance, people work with their teams? Instead of having, you know, a bunch of desks pushed together where people say, oh, did you talk to Tom? Did you get to see the email from Sarah? This kind of thing, where you actually, and this is something a lot of research universities are pushing for, is how do we have people who are completely in different parts of the business sitting around each other? So you have finance and marketing next to each other, and you have, you know, creative and sales or this kind of thing, where you have people who don't work together sitting next to each other. So you have that bond, but you have that idea where if they are going to talk about the business, they'll come up with something that isn't on the agenda, right? Because they're talking about totally separate parts of it. And I think diversity is so exciting because we are all different. It helps break that cookie cutter idea where we're all supposed to be the same anyway. And it makes us lean into this idea that our differences are this huge competitive advantage. Working with someone with different ideas or someone that challenges us might be the best thing to happen in our career. And so I think this idea of learning what a huge competitive advantage diversity is will be better for business. It'll be better for us as people, thinking we all have to fit this mold of this perfect employee or this ideal person within the company. And just this great way of thinking about humanity as a whole, right? That somebody different from us has a value to us and could be something great is about to happen. Wouldn't that be amazing if we met someone different and said, oh, what is this going to be? This is exciting.
So we're coming towards the end. I have a couple of, well, two last questions. One is, if you could magically solve any healthy office or workplace problem, what would it be?
I think I would want to move away from, you know, when we started workplaces, it kind of came out of industrialization, right? And industrialization came from sort of the model of the farm life and working when there was daylight out. And then factories were very much the more hours you put in, the more parts you could make, the more things you could sell. I think one of the biggest things is just separating ourselves from this idea of factory work and industrialization. So this 40-hour work week, this manager making sure that you're sitting at your desk and working, getting away from this idea of kind of treating people so much different than we actually are. We're very dynamic. Sometimes we're incredibly high energy levels. Sometimes we have new young children and our schedules are different. It doesn't mean that we're not as creative. The brain changes amazingly when we have young children and there's so much to tap into, but we have to start accepting people for where they are at that moment. You and I had this great conversation about retirement, right? You work your entire life and then you have a last day and then you don't work anymore. And is that how we should treat people who have so much knowledge in the industry that they either have to work just as hard as they did in their younger days, or they have to stop altogether? I really believe if we accept this idea that a 40-hour work week isn't the ideal for just the human being as an animal, and we say, sometimes you'll be 40, sometimes, you know, you might want to cut down. Sometimes it makes sense for someone who wants to retire to go part-time first or do some projects or do this kind of thing. So I think we need to I think one of the biggest successes is accepting people as people and the complexities that we are and stop trying to act like we work in a factory.
I don't want to get worked up on this. I just want to say yes, because I'm thinking like we made up this system of work and workplace. Why does it need to be like that? We can redo it if we think it's not the right thing. So yes, wonderful wish. I'm in for it. So last one, who else should I have on the podcast? And is there something you would like to ask them?
Okay. There's a few people that I could definitely recommend. A lot of them are researchers. Weston Baxter out of Imperial College London is doing some amazing research and just comes up with some of the coolest experiments with his team at the university. And I would pressure him to answer, you know, what experiments should we be conducting within our own workplaces or what things should we be shaking up a little bit? He's a good shaker in that way. You should read some of his work. It's brilliant. Ethan Bernstein from Harvard Business School is just doing incredible things with innovation and how we can work differently as teams and people. And also he's shaking up the agile work and different ways that we can do that. And anything he says will be great. So yeah, I would just say, what are you working on now? That's always the best answer. I think those are some great people who should be on the podcast next. And yeah, I'm just honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And with that, I'm actually going to close. It's been really interesting to have you again and dive a bit deeper in a couple of the topics. So thanks that you took the time.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. We have just released a study on data readiness in CRE, along with the opportunity to assess your organization's workplace insight score. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.